From Washington, this is the CQ Budget Podcast, your leading Capitol Hill source on how Congress allocates federal taxpayer dollars. And welcome back to the CQ Budget Podcast. I'm David Lerman, your budget tracker. And this week's podcast will feature a webinar presentation on President Biden's fiscal 2025 budget request that I conducted on March 20 for CQ subscribers with my CQ roll call colleagues, Aidan Quigley, Caitlin Riley, and Paul Krawczyk. As you'll see, we dissected some of the highlights of Biden's spending and tax proposals, some of the accounting maneuvers he relies on to pump up non-defense spending, and the prospects for taking up the plan in an election year. Here now is part of that conversation. But meanwhile, we do want to talk about the coming fiscal year because the White House has already put out its budget request for fiscal 2025, about a month late, we should say. But we've been delayed on current year, so you can't really criticize them much for that. So we did a few graphics here for folks to look at just to pull some of the highlights that struck us that's worth noting, I think. We'll just go through these briefly and see if what questions people have. But first, you see the top line numbers here, and where spending is almost $2 trillion over revenue, and that's why we have the deficit projected to be about $1.8 trillion for the coming fiscal year. That's in line with the steady up creep that we've seen. It keeps going up. This budget is full of election year promises, and I think that's the way to frame this budget request, really, because none of this is going to happen in a divided government just before an election, but it does serve as sort of a campaign platform that Biden can use this fall as he fights for a second term, and he's certainly going to be pointing to pieces of this budget request to show where he wants to lead the country. That includes these items you see here, where a big focus of his has been on trying to lower drug prices by expanding the number of drugs that are subject to Medicare negotiating with drug manufacturers. They want to encompass a lot more drugs now to lower their prices. He's pushing to restore that expanded child tax credit that we saw during the pandemic that Democrats say cut child poverty nearly in half briefly because then it was rescinded. They really want to bring that back. We see a big push in this budget from Biden for housing policy. There has been a real concern in the White House about housing costs really going up, and that's why people aren't feeling the good economic times. They're trying to address that in this budget by trying to make housing more affordable. That includes this measure for a new mortgage relief credit of up to $10,000 over 2 years to help people buy homes. And you see what's been a real concern of Democrats recently over the past year, I'd say, which is the full funding for the Women, Infants, Children program known as WIC, which provides nutrition for low-income mothers and children. There had been projections of $1 billion shortfall in that program. And we think that Congress has made up that shortfall in the omnibus we're going to see. And then this budget from Biden provides full funding for that. So those are just some examples of some of the Democratic priorities that you see in Biden's budget here. But how does he pay for that, right? And that's really the nub here, because he's calling for, as we've seen in his past budgets, he's calling for higher taxes again on corporations and upper-income households. You can see some of the tax increases proposed there. Caitlin, we've seen a lot of these in the past, right? This is sort of a famous replay that doesn't seem like it's going to get very far.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of these in the past, and many of these are things that were floated when Democrats had control of both the House and the Senate, and they didn't make it into law. So this wish list doesn't look like something that is likely to make it very far this year. Perhaps these are likely ideas that you'll see floated again next year when the 2017 tax cuts expire, and you'll sort of see everyone push their tax agenda to get it into, you know, whatever legislation comes out of that. But most of these ideas look pretty unlikely to make it into law this year, especially in light of the struggles the bipartisan Wyden Smith tax deal has been facing in the Senate.
Right. They couldn't even do a more modest package so far. And so something like this, which Republicans fiercely oppose, just isn't going to get very far. And that, of course, is going to create a big hole in Biden's budget. Mm-hmm. Number four here, protecting entitlements. Again, Biden pledges no cuts to Social Security or Medicare. To shore up Medicare, he's calling to increase the Medicare tax rate for incomes above $400,000 to abide by his tax pledge of, you know, no tax increases for people who make less than $400,000. He's trying to close what they call a loophole where businesses avoid a Medicare tax. He's hinted at wanting to fix Social Security with higher taxes on wealthy households, but I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think the budget really comes up with specific proposals there. He's leaving it really for future debate as to how to fix Social Security, and they've got time on that because I can't remember when the insolvency date is, but it's, I want to say 2033 or somewhere along there. He's, you know, there's still time before the crisis hits. So in an election year, it's inconceivable to me that they would come up with some bold plan there on Social Security that's going to raise a lot of opposition and cause them more headaches that won't get very far anyway. So sort of a status quo on entitlements, but of course that's entitlements. The Congressional Budget Office will tell you are the big cost driver that pushes up deficits. And until you fix that, you're not really controlling deficits. Speaking of which, number five here on deficit reduction, Biden is sensitive to these claims from Republicans that he's spending way too much money. He's trying to win back independent voters. And so he is claiming his budget is fiscally responsible. He's claiming over $3 trillion in lower deficits over the coming decade compared to what's previously been projected. That doesn't mean deficits are going down. It just means they're increasing by less than was previously projected, right? The CBO is projecting $20 trillion of deficits over the next decade. Biden cuts that down to about $16 trillion. But he does that mostly by relying on these tax increases that Republicans already vow to oppose. And if you look at how, you know, almost half of that deficit savings really comes from just increasing the corporate tax rate that generates over $1 trillion alone. I mean, that, you know, and that's not going to happen, right, Paul? I mean, so there's a lot of wishful thinking here, even as Biden is claiming all this deficit reduction.
And that's right. And I just noticed we have a question about is the deficit reduction all from taxes or is it from spending cuts? If you look at just the proposal for next year, 2025, the Biden budget, and if you compare the Biden budget to the CBO baseline of what spending and taxes would be if no laws are changed, if laws stay the same, the Biden budget will spend about $500 billion more, and it will tax about $500 billion more. So what that tells you for next year is that, you know, the budget may claim various savings, but the deficit reduction and the deficit under the Biden budget is about the same as the CBO deficit. So looking at next year, there is not any significant deficit reduction or spending cuts. There's increased spending and increased taxes proposed.
Right. I think the confusion there, though, is that this is a 10-year projection that we're looking at here, where they're claiming all this deficit savings. They don't save much at all, just in a single year. I think Biden would argue it's sort of a combination of both tax increases and some cost savings that contribute to his deficit reduction. if you consider like lower drug costs, right, that lowers what Medicare has to pay in drugs. There's a cost savings there. So they would argue it's a combination of both of those spending cuts and tax increases that drive their deficit reduction. But, you know, to me, again, the key there is it's so much of it is tied up with tax increases that aren't going to happen, so that, you know, the projection sort of falls apart pretty quickly. And the White House surely knows that, but it's a talking point for them that they can take on the campaign trail and say, look, if you're serious about deficit reduction, here's how we can do it, folks. But the Republicans won't let us. Okay, so number six. So big fight over discretionary spending, as there always is. It's only about a quarter of total spending. But this is the part that Congress fights over through annual appropriations. It's what we're waiting for this omnibus bill today for. It's always a right political target. We know we're looking at a total budget pie discretionary of about $1.67 trillion. We know that because it was basically already set. If folks remember last year when they suspended the debt limit, they also put in budget caps for this coming fiscal year as part of that to make Republicans happier. And so they've already agreed to this overall discretionary limit of $1.67 trillion. And you see there the breakdown between defense and non-defense. But Biden was able to boost a little more non-defense than we thought. We'll get to that in a little bit. Because of all the side deals that were the famous side deals that were part of that debt limit law last year, that Aiden can talk about in a little bit. It was kind of interesting. So he's giving himself a little more wiggle room to play with on non-defense spending, which is going to irritate Republicans who are trying to cut non-defense spending. But there we are. That's sort of his proposal. Quickly on some other points, the debt climbed steadily. We shouldn't forget, going from nearly $30 trillion up to $45 trillion over the decade, steady path upward. And it is number eight, it assumes a relatively rosy economic outlook, as White House budgets almost always do, right? Because if you predict a recession, it's not going to help you, and it's going to make your budget numbers look a lot worse. So they always pick good times are here to stay for the whole decade, because that'll make their numbers so much easier. It makes the math so much easier. And so here, Biden's projecting GDP growth of about 2% this coming year, gradually increasing to 2.2%, no recessions, just steady as she goes, strong economy. And most crucially, they're predicting inflation holds steady throughout the decade at about 2.3%. I mean, that's, you know, we've seen how inflation can shoot up during the pandemic. That would send these numbers into a tailspin here if that happens again. But Biden is predicting steady inflation, steady low inflation, which is going to help his numbers. And of course, he's predicting unemployment basically holding steady, slightly declining over the decade. So that helps him too. Number nine, interest payments are rising. This is something that would always alarm conservatives. And it's always a scary number to me on that line item when I look at net interest costs that the federal government's paying, just from it's just not an efficient way to run a railroad, right? We're now paying more in interest than we are on the entire national defense. That says something. It says you're just spending money to pay interest on your credit card. All that money that could be devoted into programs or tax cuts are instead being used just to pay interest on the debt. It's a huge problem, and it's growing. And we can't, you know, that has to be stressed, because it's something that you hear all this talk about a fiscal commission to look at ways to get debt down. These net interest costs are just going to keep growing. It almost doubles over the decade here, $965 billion this coming year to nearly $1.5 trillion in interest at the end of the decade. Ugly numbers. And the final point, of course, is that this is a late start yet again. The budget is a month late. Budget law calls for the president's budget to come out the first Monday in February. That didn't happen. It often doesn't happen. There's no penalty for missing that deadline. And because this year's process was so delayed, it's only natural that the coming year's process is going to start out delayed. There's almost no chance of this passing on time. They need this budget by October 1st, would be the start of the new fiscal year. Guys, let me know if anyone disagrees. I see no chance at all of this being passed by October 1st, which means look for another struggle over continuing resolutions, those stopgap measures to avoid a shutdown coming this fall, and we start all over again. Anybody disagree with that?
No, especially in an election year, the chances of them passing anything on time, it's impossible.
Like, it sounds like everyone agrees. Okay. And let's just turn quickly to this other graphic, Lydia, if you can, because I thought this is interesting to Dem. We ran this in CQ, and it gets a little technical. I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but it does show how you can play with the numbers from these side deals. You know, they set these caps on discretionary spending last year. But then there were these side deals, never written on paper, that allowed for some extra spending, right, that wouldn't count against the caps. And the White House has clearly played with those side deal numbers to pump up non-defense spending. If you see here in the chart, defense spending is basically right in line with the deal, and it grows. You know, that deal, folks will remember, limited the increase this year to 1%. They're on discretionary. They're really trying to hold the line. They just allowed for a 1% increase. Well, the defense numbers fall in line with that. That's roughly a 1% increase there that you see. But non-defense, if my math was right, is something like a 2.5% increase that Biden was able to boost a little extra money from. And Aidan, I don't know if you're prepared to walk us through how he does that, but you know, you start with this base of the $710 billion for non-defense, and then he's added, the side deals get a little generous, right?
Yeah, totally. I think the chart does a really good job of kind of laying out some of the basics here. As you can see, emergency funds is the main way they do this. But I think taking a wider look and a step back, you know, fiscal 2025 appropriations right now looks like it's going to be a total mess, largely because of the way that the fiscal 2024 process has played out, specifically the deal between Speaker Johnson and Majority Leader Schumer, which really kind of, pulled up some of the gimmicks, might not be the right word, but that's what I'll go with here, you know, from fiscal 2025 to fiscal 2024, specifically, you know, $10 billion in IRS rescissions. You know, which we're going to, you know, $11 billion. They're going to be split between 2024 and 2025. But in the deal with Schumer, that Johnson and the House Republicans pulled up $11 billion into 2024, which kind of created a hole here in 2025. They'll have to figure out. But of course, the Biden administration, they want as much non-defense spending as they could possibly get in the budget request. So they kind of, took a path here in the budget that the House Republicans will not go for when we get to the endgame negotiations. But as David talked about earlier, you know, we'll have at least one continuing resolution. Lame duck, Omni is possible for 25, but it all really depends on how the elections go and, you know, what the different parties want to do when we know who the president and, Congress majorities are going to be.
Yeah, you can see in this chart, by the way, how much the emergency funding has increased from $12 billion up to $23 billion this coming year. You know, when you're willing to call a lot more money emergency, then it's more money to play with. And then where it says rescissions, it gets very technical, but a lot of that money comes from the Children's Health Insurance Program. They play that game every year where there's more money. That's mandatory funding, and there's more money in that account every year than they actually need. So they claw it back and claim a savings because they weren't going to spend that money anyway, and they can pump it into discretionary programs. And that's what you see here with the $51 billion. And then HUD receipts is basically projections of revenue that the housing department gets from rental income. and the Biden folks are just predicting an increase in how much revenue they're getting there. And then that last one is Transportation Security Administration fees. You know, the White House is just projecting, you know, $1.6 billion extra this coming year because they're going to, those fees normally go in, are used for transportation. They're just calling for diverting it into the general fund so that they can tap it for discretionary programs. Whether Republicans allow them to do that would seem doubtful to me, but that's what they're claiming here. And that pumps up all this, their total ceiling on non-defense spending. So they have more money to play with, but we'll have a big fight over that. And we're going to see how Republicans respond to that pretty quickly.
Yeah. I mean, sorry to interrupt. It's definitely not surprising that the Biden administration, you know, the president's budget every year under any president is kind of a wish list and a dream scenario of what their priorities are. It's kind of more of a messaging document than an appropriations document, really, when it comes down to it. So, you know, I think it's important to note that, you know, this is a dream of the Biden administration here on this ideal and stuff, but it's really going to the final project, you know, the final, what we end up seeing at the end of the day is going to be negotiated, and it's going to be, you know, at least 7 months away. 8, 9, 10, who knows? It's going to be a long time in the future.
Right. And Kaylin, we haven't addressed on his tax stuff. Well, you did address it briefly, but are there any of those tax measures that you think might actually survive here?
I couldn't tell you. I do think like the next best opportunity to see significant changes in taxes will be when the 2017 cuts expire at the end of 2025. But so much of that will depend on what happens in the election, who controls the Senate, who controls the House, and who controls the White House. So it's really difficult at this point to predict what's in play next year or what the final outcome will look like. I don't think any of these proposals are likely to see action in 2024. Like we said, there's a much smaller bill that's balanced between Republican and Democratic priorities pretty evenly that is now stalled in the Senate. So the outlook for kind of more ambitious progressive tax, more ambitious tax proposals from Democrats are unlikely to fare well at this point.
Yeah, we should remind folks that the Trump tax cuts that Republicans are still very proud of, right, from 2017, a lot of those expire after 2025, right?
Yeah.
So that's when you're going to see a push to extend them.
Yeah, and Republicans would like to make those permanent. So Democrats and Republicans are starting pretty far apart in what they would like to see out of those negotiations. And then a lot of this will depend on what shakes out in the election.
Which is another point I noticed. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, it's a nonpartisan research group, put out an analysis yesterday, I think it was, that noted that Biden's budget does not assume any of these tax cuts being extended, right? So that helps his math, because if you don't extend those tax cuts for now, you assume you're going to have a lot more revenue in later years than you're actually going to have if you extend those tax cuts. And that's going to be a real dilemma for Biden, because I think everybody expects that those tax cuts would be extended at least for those who make under $400,000 a year, right? Because that was Biden's pledge. And so all of a sudden he's in a catch-22, right? Because if he extends those tax cuts, he suddenly has a big hole in revenue that he has to make up, and his budget's out of whack. If he doesn't extend the tax cuts, he's going to be accused of raising taxes on those who make less than $400,000, right? So that's going to be a box he has to climb out of. But of course, he may not have to address that until after the election, Kaylin, I would think, right?
Yeah, it's very unlikely that you would see it addressed before the election, would be my guess. And then I think on the tax side and election side, the other thing worth noting are the housing credits that were proposed in here, because I do think we're already seeing kind of an increased emphasis on housing from a messaging standpoint. I think Biden was in Nevada recently touting kind of the American Rescue Plan housing spending. And so I do the credit for people buying homes. And then on the other side of it, there's also a $10,000 credit that would go to people selling kind of starter homes. And so you are seeing, I think, just like a greater emphasis from a messaging perspective put on housing and housing costs and bringing those down.
Yeah. Could that mortgage housing credit survive, maybe? Is that popular enough?
That has not, I've not seen that floated on in the hallways or on the Hill yet. But there are housing provisions in the Wyden-Smith bill. Those were included at the behest of House Democrats, and Senate Democrats are very supportive too. And it, those credits tend to have support on both sides of the aisle, but those would go to building or rehabilitating low-income or affordable housing. And so you do see housing provisions in that tax bill. I don't see any of the budget proposals making it in, because right now you're seeing the push is to get Senate Republicans on board. So no, I wouldn't see those making it into something this year, but I think from a messaging perspective, you're going to hear more and more about housing and housing costs and things the administration is doing to bring those down.
And Paul, you've covered a lot of budgets over many years now. How much of a rewrite is Biden's budget going to get? How radically different will the Republican budgets be? What are we looking at here? Can you outline any key differences that we should look for between the competing plans?
Well, I mean, the way I look at it is, I think that, of course, it will all depend on, who the president is and who controls the Senate and the House next year. But I think the more appropriate comparison is to, and we haven't seen, the second six bill package yet. But I think, look at the six bill package that passed and the one that's going to pass, that's the 12 bills. The appropriations package, which is passed next year, is going to look a lot more like that than it's going to look like the Biden budget. So WIC, for example, right? So they increase, Democrats wanted full funding for WIC, and full funding for WIC made it into this, this year's appropriations.
This is the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program.
Right. And so the Biden budget is proposing full funding for WIC, and that's a very high priority for Democrats. So you're probably going to see something like full funding for WIC in next year's appropriation. So if you look at the Biden proposals and you find proposals there that are pretty similar to what have been agreed to this year, that's what next year's appropriations are likely to be.
Any other thoughts on how quickly any of these fiscal 25 appropriations bills could move, Aiden? I mean, we know they won't finish on time. Mm-hmm. No way by September. But, every year it seems like they start out with these high hopes that we're going to get all our bills passed by the summer. And are we going to see that again? Is there going to be some feint toward progress? And
I mean, I have to imagine that this year there's some more realism from all parties on when we'll see things, when we'll see the process wrap up. But of course, we're going to see the Senate and House both go through their normal processes, is the expectation, so House bills will be on the, go through committee and be on the floor in the June, July timeframe would be my estimate. That's the normal schedule. We're still working on 24. So of course things could be delayed a little bit, but in a normal year, we would see markup start in May and June. In both chambers. But of course, with the sprint to the finish here for fiscal 24, that might be a little ambitious this year. But long story short, we'll see And no final appropriations until after the election is my guess. And it'd be stunning if they did wrap up fiscal 25 on time or close to on time.
Hasn't happened for decades, so I won't hold my breath. So that was part of our webinar discussion of Biden's new budget. If you like what you heard here, you can subscribe to the CQ Budget newsletter, which hits your inbox every morning the Congress is in session. You can find that at CQ.com. You can find all of our budget coverage on CQ.com or rollcall.com. My thanks to Aidan Quigley, Caitlin Riley, and Paul Krawczyk for joining me on the webinar. And thank you all for listening. I'm David Lerman, your budget tracker. Until next time.